Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful weekend in St. Louis. Well, it was until it wasn't last night.
It has. The weather has been fantastic, and then all hell broke loose. My God. You weren't going to that soccer game, were you?
I didn't. I made it to the Cards game, and the Cards game was great. And then we were doing some stuff in the afternoon, and we slowly watched the weather just deteriorate. It was pretty rapid. It went from a beautiful day in the 60s to hail.
Yeah. You were kind enough to share tickets for the soccer game with one of the residents, and he was so grateful. But it turned into just like, I think the start time was delayed 2 hours, but they got the win, St. Louis City.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. They're pretty impressive. You know, they're certainly doing better than the Cards, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So we have a special episode. This is a joint episode with the British Society for Surgery of the Hand, and we have some great guests. Do you want to give the audience an intro?
Yeah. So this segment, we did one a few months back, and, you know, had some great guests, Dominic Power and Amy Moore. And, you know, there was clearly a high download hit rate. So people were pretty excited about it. It's really fun to collaborate with this group. You know, so we're going to have two guests joining us, and we're going to talk about CMC and Keenbox. And I think it's going to be fun. Maria Esplugas is going to join us, and we can formally introduce her when she joins us. And David McComb is going to join us. So we're crossing continents here. We've got Maria is from Barcelona, and David's from down under. So this will be really fun.
Yeah, David's from Melbourne, and he was the guest editor for this European Journal of Hand Surgery volume, which was entitled Unsolved Problems in Hand Surgery. It's really good. We picked a couple of them to focus on, but really everything that you and I talk about and stress about is hit in this really interesting edition, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah, so I love when journals take the time to do special editions, and we don't see it enough, I think. But it's a nice way to get some topics out there. And honestly, for people that are looking for things to study, it's a great way to pick up some new ideas. Just kind of like what's new in hand surgery is always a fun one to just be like, oh yeah, that would be a good, it's an interesting thing to study. We should thank our friends at Practice Link. You said that I provided tickets for Andrew to go to the soccer game. It was not me. It was actually Practice Link. The Upper Hand is sponsored by PracticeLink.com, the most widely used physician job search and career advancement resource.
Becoming a physician is hard. Finding the right job doesn't have to be. Join Practice Link for free today at www.practicelink.com/theupperhand. All right. I'm super excited.
Yes. Thank you, Practice Link, for sponsoring us. And you know, thank you, British Society for Surgery of the Hand and the team at JHS Europe for this opportunity to have some fun and interview folks from Barcelona and Australia. So without further ado, why don't we jump in? Well, Chuck, here we are. We are joined by two fantastic guests. I wanted to welcome them. First off, we have Dr. Mireia Esplugas. Mireia has spent 25 years as a hand and wrist surgeon, so making me feel very young. Thank you. Mireia is a member of the Spanish Society for Surgery of the Hand, the European Wrist Arthroscopy Society, and FESH, friends of ours on the podcast. So, Mireia, welcome, and thank you for joining us from Barcelona.
Thank you very much. I am very happy to be with you today here.
Very excited, as we are too.
Yes. And David McComb is our other guest, who actually was the guest editor of the particular Journal of Hand Surgery European that we're talking about today. We have picked a couple of articles, but the entire journal is excellent. It's looking at unsolved problems in hand surgery. And David works in Melbourne at St. Vincent's Hospital and the Melbourne and Royal Children's Hospital. He's in private practice with Victorian Hand Surgery Associates, and his clinical interests are adult and children's hand surgery. And that's where our paths have overlapped with the treatment of the kids, as well as peripheral nerve and brachial plexus, which is exciting for Chris, and reconstructive microsurgery. So we are super excited. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Thanks, Chuck. It's great to be here, and very honored to be asked to participate.
Well, we like to have some fun on these episodes. The last one that we did with Amy Moore and Dominic Power was a well-received and was a nice conversation. I would love to start with the Keenbox article. And Mireia, I'd like to say that I think this was an incredibly nicely written article, very much laid out the evidence of, or the lack thereof, in terms of what we know and what we do not know about Keenbox disease. So congratulations to you and your co-authors for writing such a nice comprehensive article.
Thank you very much. It was struggling to write it, but we enjoyed it, and we enjoyed that you have enjoyed the article. Thank you very much.
There was only one thing that I would have added, and I probably would have cited Dr. Goldfarb's paper on the staging of Keenbox disease, but otherwise I think that it was incredibly comprehensive, and it made me think a lot because I struggle with this condition, and maybe Chuck and David can share their thoughts too, but the early stage Keenbox disease, knowing what to do and how to counsel patients, it's a lot easier once you get to the salvage procedures. But I don't know, maybe Mireia, we could start with your thoughts. I mean, when in your practice, when you see a patient who's got an earlier stage disease, what is the role for purely a metaphyseal cord decompression of the distal radius?
The problem with the chemo disease is that we don't really know what will happen in the future. And we don't really know if this radiological finding that we found is only a moment in the timeline of the disease, or it will be in this way for many, many times. So I think this is the most important aspect of the article, because we don't really know if whatever we plan to do to the patient will improve the disease, or the disease would improve by itself alone, and the patient would be clinically correctly for many, many years. So we think that we must avoid any treatment as much time as possible if this is able to if the patient is able to wear a good life with his disease. And if we cannot control his symptoms and we plan a surgical treatment, we really like to do the less aggressive as possible. And the decompression is an extra-articular, easy to perform and easy to recover procedure. And if you see the literature, you can find good results, good clinical results, which is not perhaps good radiological results. But if the patient is good with his disease and can have a good life, this is a good treatment for him. This is our idea.
I like that. David, maybe in a similar way to Maria, what's your general principles as you think about Keenbox? And we can maybe Chris and I'll present a case and hear what each of you think about, but how do you think about Keenbox in general?
I agree that we are operating in a sort of relatively evidence-free zone in terms of the progression. We capture the patients either when they're way down the track and it's too late for anything, or else often it's this the group that have got this the pain and some restriction of motion, a bit of synovitis, and but still have a salvageable or have an intact lunate. They're the uncommon ones in our experience. We see our patients often, they've got a fracture through their lunate. They're too far gone, and so when you see them, it's tempting to want to, because you're familiar with what we perhaps believe is the long-term result of deterioration, you want to avoid that because it's difficult. There's not a lot of great solutions for the bad Keenbox, advanced stage threes and fours. So it's tempting to try and do something active, but I agree that doing intra-articular procedures is going to stiffen the wrist. It's tempting to want to put a vascularized graft in because that makes some sense to correct the problem. But I guess I would be doing shortening osteotomies. I haven't got a lot of experience with just the metaphyseal decompression, but can I get an arthroscopy? I'm not exactly sure that I know Greg Bain's a good friend and colleague, and he's written extensively on this. And the assessment of the integrity of articular cartilage, I think, is a really difficult problem. And I think when it's bad, it's bad. But there's a big gray zone where we're not quite so sure what we're dealing with. So I think the principles of trying not to do harm makes a lot of sense at an extra-articular procedure, particularly shortening of the radius if that's feasible. I haven't got a lot of experience with the wedge for the neutral variants, but I think it's hard. That's why we chose it as a topic, because this dilemma is how hard do you go, how aggressive should you be, are we really changing people's outcomes by doing whatever intervention we're planning to do. So that was, I really appreciate Maria's and her colleagues, Alex Lutch and Co's contribution to that edition. So I thought it was really good as well. So that doesn't give you any answer there, Chuck, but I guess we're all, to a degree, it gives you a bit of flexibility that you can sort of do, provided you don't do a lot of harm, you may be doing what everyone else is doing, perhaps.
I am scared yet reassured that we are operating in an evidence-free zone, as you stated. The question that I wanted to ask each of you and get your thoughts, and I think, Chuck, I'd love your thoughts on this too. Are there any radiographic findings for you to say, I can't salvage it, or we have to go to a salvage procedure? I cannot save this lunate anymore. Maybe start with Medea, your thoughts. When do you say we can't do anything like an extra-articular procedure, like a core decompression? We cannot do an osteotomy. We cannot do a denervation. This lunate needs to go.
I think that perhaps the most useful way to decide this should be to have different controls in time and to check if it evaluates quickly, or if he doesn't, or if he's becoming unstable, or if he's having, perhaps we should not only focus on static explorations, but also dynamic explorations. And if you see that the carpal kinematics is changing because of the lunate is changing in his shape, perhaps this would be the moment to decide that it's the time to take aggressive or more aggressive surgical procedure.
Thank you for that. David, I'd love your thoughts. You know, when can you no longer do any sort of graft or flap or anything like that? When is the lunate done?
Well, I think once there's a coronal plane fracture, I think that's difficult. You know, it's very hard to if you were to contemplate bone grafting the lunate, once it's a coronal plane fracture, I think that's pretty hard to capture the front of it and try and unite the volar component to that. I think, you know, the concept of the intra-articular procedures, so they're trying to salvage the lunate that's already lost its height. If you're trying to expand that back, or if you're trying to fit a bone graft that's actually got some sort of blood supply still in it, and you're trying to squeeze it into a lunate that's reduced its proximodistal height, that's pretty challenging. It's not a very big bone. There's not a lot of real estate in that lunate at the best of times, let alone if it's already started to collapse. I think you can still do procedures like denervations, and I think you can still do, even if the lunate is non-salvageable, I think you can denervate the wrist. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. It's, you know, it can provide some relief and it's not doing harm. Whether if for that lunate doing a leveling procedure is worthwhile, perhaps. But I think once you've got those changes in the lunate structure, I'm not sure you can say that. I know people have tried to unite, and, you know, Jim Higgins with his MFT is trying to rebuild the lunate from scratch. I've not got a lot of experience with that. I use the MFT for scaphoids, but I haven't been courageous enough to tackle a lunate with one of those yet.
That's very helpful. I would agree. I really like what Maria said about the kinematics and the motion. Very important to think that way. There's not always a simplistic evaluation tool of the lunate. But the coronal plane fractures are difficult. And there is literature to suggest that one can fix those with a small screw and get them to heal. And I have certainly tried, but I don't believe I have been routinely successful. So I really appreciate that comment. Maybe, Chris, if it's okay, let's do a very quick case scenario and just ask how each of you would approach it, and then we can switch our topics if that sounds all right to everyone. Okay.
Sure.
So we have, oh, go ahead.
Could I add something? Because of this, coronal fractures are very difficult to really treat. In fact, we are moving to think that perhaps we should substitute this lunate to return to the normality, the carpal kinematics. And we are moving to try to substitute it, for instance, by a 3D printed lunate. And we are focusing there on how to stabilize it. And we are starting many projects in this way, because perhaps the most important thing is to restore the carpal kinematics and kinetics, not to try to get a healthier lunate with a good shape.
Thank you. Well, we all will look forward to your reports. Not an easy problem, for sure. So here is a case for everyone's consideration. A 35-year-old male laborer who has had central wrist pain for 5 years. You have been following him for 2 years, and the lunate by x-ray and an MRI was obtained is basically a stage 2 lunate, so it's not truly collapsed. The ulnar variance is slightly negative, and he is frustrated with his wrist pain. He has failed conservative care and wants something done. So, David, maybe we'll start with you. How do you think about this patient, and what would you consider offering him?
So I think a joint leveling procedure, if he has got negative variance to any degree, I think that that's a good operation. You know, that can form a component of your plan. He's going to end up with having a scope and having his articular surfaces examined and make sure he hasn't got that sort of shifting sand type of osteochondral fragment that's just loose on the surface. I think that would be a poor prognostic sign. The question, I guess, here is whether you believe that doing a 4-5 graft and plugging it into the back of his lunate. And this is the situation I was talking about before. This is the guy who's 35, he's a laborer. He's got another 20 years of manual work in front of him. He's not going to be as good at that if his wrist is poor, if he ends up with a partial or total wrist fusion. So, he might be the one that I would do. The trouble is, I think, that guy, he's the minority. So to build up a feeling as to whether you're doing the right thing by these patients, you really need to aggregate a lot of experience with that, I think, because it's not an easy operation. And, you know, if you have a bad result, is it the technique? Is it the principle of the surgery that doesn't work? You know, as Maria is saying, are we not, we may be revascularizing the bone, but are we restoring the height and maintaining kinematics and normal mechanics? So, but you asked me the question, and my answer is I probably would. He would be the guy that I might do this for. So I'd shorten him and I'd take the 4-5 graft and then do the osteotomy through that donor site, bring that down a little bit. And I would just carve out my slot in the back of the lunate and plug it in there.
Perfect.
And then I would wait.
Thank you. That's helpful. Before I turn to Maria, does every patient get an arthroscopy as part of the procedure to assess the articular cartilage?
I think if it's a stage two, if they're not just having a splint and resting and observation, if I'm contemplating doing something, I want to have a scope. I want to do a scope. And part of that's diagnostic. Part of that's gaining experience. It's, you know, trying to learn what the MRI finding really means. I think it's, we're learning with, you know, the arthroscopic distal radius fixation and arthroscopic scaphoid fixation and everything else now that the scope is really just part of the diagnostic sort of algorithm, really, rather than necessarily being an operation itself.
Perfect. Maria?
I think that the arthroscopy is not only a good evaluating tool, but also it's good for the patient because you always find a sign of it is there, which is perhaps the one of the reasons of his central pain. You find the cartilage flaps that you can debride, and this may also be at the source of patient's pain. So I think that we should always scope a Kinbock, mixing it with other treatments. And in this particular case that you have explained, I would scope, I would evaluate and treat intra-articular as in the radiocarpal as intermediate carpal, and then I would add. I would add an extra-articular osteotomy because many patients with the osteotomy get better with their pain. You do not perhaps modify the disease evolution, but the patient is better. And I think that if in this particular case, which is a manual labor, which is 35, the only thing that he wants is to have less pain and without interfering in his mobility because he has to have a good wrist. Only with this, you can improve him and wait if in the future there are more benefits to offer to him surgically, if he needs them.
Thank you. All right, Chris, I'd love to hear your thoughts and see if you would approach this any differently.
Well, I'm going to bring some sanity to this discussion as somebody who is not a master arthroscopist. I'm happy that this is a ligament stage 2, which means our lunate is still in reasonable shape. I'm going to stay out of this gentleman's wrist and leave that for when I have to inevitably come back, because we will all be coming back for this patient for future surgery. So I'm going to leave the wrist.
Well, maybe not if the vascularized bone graft cures the problem. It might.
Well, no, because according to the evidence or lack thereof, a joint leveling procedure and a denervation will do very well for this patient. So that's all I'm going to offer this patient. Do a leveling procedure from the volar side, do the denervation from the volar approach that we already have, leave the dorsum of the wrist completely intact. So I'm going to close it there so that you can't disagree with me. And then maybe we can talk about our next topic. David, you authored a really great review article for treatment of early stage thumb CMC arthrosis. And I, again, enjoyed this thoroughly because it really walked us through all the issues. You know, for you, when is early stage truly early stage? Is it purely radiographic? Because we know that sometimes the radiographic findings don't correlate with, you know, patients' actual symptoms.
Well, I think so. The focus of this was really that troubling group where you don't want to proceed down the road of trapezectomy or with whatever variation of stabilization you want to do, because this is the 40-year-old patient. And the prospect of a suspension plasty or, sorry, a trapezectomy lasting another 40 years is daunting. So this work was done by, a lot of this was done by my colleague, Steve Tam, who works with me, and he has done a lot on basal thumb kinematics and this problem of the early patient, with the idea of that subluxation, if you truly can identify it, and I think in the article we've described the role of CT scan in accurately defining what is and is not subluxed. Then there's a role for stabilizing it, is provided the majority of the articular cartilage is intact. So again, a little bit like we were talking about before with the keen box and the role of arthroscopy, there's a role for actually visualizing the cartilage, and you can be pretty things that look okay on X-ray can be somewhat disappointing when you've actually visualize the articular cartilage itself. You can see big bare areas on the base of metacarpal and trapezium. So I think that's a very long-winded way of not really answering your question, Chris, but patients with persistent pain that don't settle down with simple splinting and those treatments we all use, cortisone injection maybe, and then it's an ongoing disability for them. They've got pain at rest, pain with minimal activity. Then that sort of triggers the investigation with the CT and then scope plus minus the ligament reconstruction. If you're confident that you actually have true subluxation, subluxation is a little bit of a difficult thing. Clinically, it's a hard thing to assess. I think, you know, a lot of people who are a little hypermobile can move their thumbs around and have a pretty significant range. So trying to be accurate about what you define as sublux, I think, is important in this.
I have not used, I love those comments, and I've obviously thought about this quite a bit. I have not used a CT scan in my early stage patients, perhaps because I have not thought about going to more of a soft tissue based or, you know, reconstructive type surgery in that particular population. Medea, are you using CT scans to evaluate your thumb CMC patients at all?
I usually use ultrasound. Why? Because I have an ultrasound equipment in my consultation. And because it helps me to check if there is any joint effusion. You can also see the loose bodies. And I come back to dynamic pathology as came up before. I think that early CMC disease is a synovium disease, which can have a biomechanical basis during grip. So with my ultrasound, I put my proper endovolar aspect of the joint, and I ask the patient to pinch and to grip, and I can compare with the other thumb, and I see if it's too hypermobile, or if he compresses too much, or if there is any effusion there, or if the metacarpal bone dorsally subluxates during the pinch. And this, for me, this is the definition of the early stage of a CMC pathology.
I know that Chris loves that. He has recently become an ultrasound fan. I am not. Maria, I assume that you share David's thoughts on the benefits of arthroscopy as well?
Yes. Yes. I think that arthroscopy allows you to remove the loose body that you very, very often found in the volar aspect of the joint. And you can check, you can do a mechanical synovectomy, which could be compared with the corticoid injection that you can do under the ultrasound. And you also see the joint and the surface and the osteophyte, the joint surface, and you connect there. I do not recommend the electrocoagulation of the ligaments to tighten them because I really think that mechanoreceptors and the proprioception helps in that to stabilize the joint. So the electro burning of the mechanoreceptors, I don't think that it's a good point to that. But yes, I scope them, and I think it's beneficial for the patient.
Can I ask Maria and Chris, how long do you think the learning curve for an ultrasound to become so comfortable that what you're seeing is actually pathological and not just part of the normal variance?
I think that you can always compare with the other hand. So it's not, yes, it's difficult to learn, but it's not so much difficult. And if you have any depth, you go to the other CMC joint and compare. And you can realize if this is pathologic or it's normal for the patient.
Chris, have you used, I know you know, everything is nerve, and you use your ultrasound to assess the nerve. Have you used ultrasound to assess joints?
I haven't. I think also I'd want to make sure I have the right size probe for that, but now I'm intrigued and maybe I will. I'll say the limits for me right now are honestly just time and not having that built into my workflow yet, but I'm intrigued and may start to explore this. There was, I think, Chuck, you had one question. I wanted to piggyback off of Mireya's comment about the thermal capsulorraphy and the importance of proprioception. I know that Elizabeth Hoggart has published a bit on the thumb CMC innervation, but there are some proponents for denervation. So I guess I wanted quick thoughts on that. And then I know Chuck wanted to close with one more question. So Mireya and David, what are your thoughts on denervation for thumb CMC?
Thumb denervation in advanced CMC joint pathology, I believe that it's a good point to restore a good life for the patient, because in this lab biomechanical receptors studies that you referred, we participated in that, and we found that with age the mechanoreceptors density gets down, so you are not damaging proprioception if you denervate when the patient is not young.
Maria, can I ask you a question? I know I'm supposed to be answering questions, but I'm fascinated that. So for the 30-year-old woman who's hypermobile, do you believe you can, by virtue of strengthening the thumb with their proprioceptive arc intact, and can we stabilize? Yeah, can we produce a stable thumb CMC under load, or is that unrealistic? And do we need to be doing reconstructive surgery, or what do you think about that?
So we collaborated with Natalie Mobarga in the article, which promotes first dorsal interosseous strengthening and opponent strengthening to stabilize the joint. We were there in the lab, and we really saw that they are the main stabilizers, first dorsal interosseous and opponents. And in Spain, we do not have hand therapists. We do not have, we have few hand therapists. So our patients do not have a hand therapist team to go. And we learn them how to strengthen their first dorsal interosseous and their opponents, and we follow the patients. And yes, we see that many, I don't know which is the percentage, but I feel that patients who really do well their exercise, many of them get improved. So yes, I would recommend to strengthen first dorsal interosseous and opponents.
Perfect. Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I'd like to close with one question, or one, it's a comment, but it is a question as well. So like you, I enjoy arthroscopy anywhere and everywhere. And I believe for early CMC, it can be very helpful. My question is, and this article included it, we always hear that a closing wedge osteotomy of the base of the metacarpal can be helpful. And I always look for the opportunity to do that procedure, and I just never find the right patient. So what am I missing? And how often is that closing wedge osteotomy appropriate? Maria, you want to start?
I only have performed one or two in my life, and I have scoped many, many CMC joints, because I really do not know which percentage of surface is the good to indicate a CMC, a firm metacarpal osteotomy. So I think I am as you, Charles.
David, teach us.
Well, I'd love to, Chuck, but I can't. I again, exactly the same. I haven't I haven't got much experience with that operation. We put it in our algorithm of treatment for the patient with early arthrosis without subluxation. But to be honest, the group that you see, they're either too far gone, or there is this subset that we talked about in our article who have got the subluxation, early arthritis, symptomatic subluxation, and they do pretty well with the ligament reconstruction. And I think in part that's because they get stiffer. We're reducing their range of motion. Maybe that's what helps with the pain. We're sort of making them very stable. But I haven't got much experience with the extension osteotomy. I guess, you know, the tibia, I'm a plastic surgeon, and the concept of doing a closing wedge osteotomy in a tibia for a bit of arthritis seems pretty terrifying to me. And I guess it's just the same idea. But I haven't seen that patient. I see this group of patients with the instability who've got pain and some early arthrosis. And then the next group, the ones where it's, you know, they're eating three and eating four and they're too far gone. And then it's just a matter of managing the symptom and then doing the operation when they're ready. So, I'm with you. It's the unicorn.
Yes, I've only seen that patient on a test question. So I've not seen that patient in my clinic yet. David and Mireya, thank you for joining us for this great conversation. It's fascinating that we've had the opportunity to interview you for this, you know, with David, you being in Australia, Mireya being in Barcelona. Thank you to the British Society and the European Journal for collaborating with us on this. And, you know, honestly, this unsolved problems in hand surgery journal edition is fantastic. So we encourage anybody who is listening to please check it out. So David and Mireya, thank you. And we look forward to having you join us again sometime soon.
Thanks very much. Thanks for asking us along.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand. Come back next time.